You and I back together again, wrapping up a very busy week, Friday, September 15th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We looked at some new plans to possibly convert a building at the Connecticut Post Mall into apartments. We welcome Lauren Grush, author of The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. And Chris Caruso stopped by to give his latest thoughts in his weekly update. What's that old phrase, that old notion, that old axiom? What is that? Adapt or die? Is that it? I had that pop in my head on this Friday, September 15th, halfway through the month, hearing Chris do that story at the top of the hour. The owners of the Connecticut Post Mall in Milford going to try it again. They're offering a new idea to add housing on the property. Now, remember, when this was done, I think a couple of years ago, the city of Milford, I think the mayor and some other folks said, no, we don't want that. Now, why they didn't want it, I have no idea. But you have to understand something. Malls are dying. Listen, I still go to malls, but the notion of the big, expansive, enclosed shopping mall is not doing well. It's just not. Take a walk through the Trumbull Mall. Take a walk through the Connecticut Post Mall. Take a walk through the Meriden Mall. Take a walk through, you know, the mall at Buckland Hills. Yeah, they're still open. Yeah, there's still a lot of people there. But take a look at the turnover of stores there. And take a look at how many stores are empty. And again, it's no indictment of the mall's owner, the people that set up their businesses here. Again, the sense of a mall, the notion of it still does make some sense on some level. We understand that. But again, the prevalence of online shopping, and I know it's not a full shopping experience, and even the people that run online shopping, people like Walmart and Amazon, still have some brick and mortar presence here. But again, Centennial Real Estate wants regulations in the city of Milford. And by the way, if you have a feeling on this, I'd love to know, especially if you live in the area, if you're a Milford, Stratford resident, what do you think of this? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. They want city regulations to be changed to allow the addition of apartments. Previous efforts, it says here, and you remember this is a couple of years ago, I think, were rejected by city planners. Centennial went back to the drawing board, and city officials say the addition of new green space should make the plan more attractive. Phase one would involve redeveloping the closed Sears department store, which, you know, is in back of the mall there, and the auto parts building into retail and apartments. Now, and there's notion that this is going to happen in other areas. You see that mall in Stamford is still in the process, I guess, of opening up some central location where if you're into pickleball, you can pickleball you to your heart's content in that mall. I know I go to the Meriden Mall sometimes up by the intersection of 691 and 91 there. If there's a particular store, I have to get something in. And I notice now, you know, some of the medium-sized stores are not there anymore, so they're trying to do kind of an elegant dining thing, and they're trying to do, what's the other thing? Oh, almost like a mini theater, like a supper club with entertainment. Now, it's been a while since I've seen the coming soon thing, and, you know, there's a lot of variables between coming soon and actually getting it done. But I'm glad this is revving up again in Milford. And I was wondering why it got shot down the first time. But in general, yes, some malls are still doing well. And that's a big product of where the mall is, what types of clientele, what variety of clientele a particular mall is able to generate, what kind of tenants they can get. What's the layout? Safety's another thing, too. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So according to this story, I guess they're going to make another run here that was shot down the first time by the city folk, the city authorities in Milford. The owners of the Connecticut Post Mall want to offer a new proposal for housing on the property. Why not? Hell, I might live in a mall. Or a converted mall. I'm telling you, folks, you're going to see more and more of these malls eventually. I'm not wishing ill will or unfortunate business decisions on people. But you're going to see more and more of these malls over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years drastically cut back their retail footprint and I think go more with a housing kind of thing. The infrastructure is there. Now, you've got to dump millions into it, subdividing everything, but the main entrances are there, the main hallways are there. I mean, think about any mall you walk through, whether it's Meriden, whether it's Trumbull, whether it's, Milford, whether it's any of the other malls around the state where you say to yourself, they could subdivide this sucker. I'd live here. Restaurants downstairs, a nice indoor workout facility, maybe a nice indoor gym or something like that. I mean, sure. Why not? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. And I guess the project would include doing something with that old Sears department store and the auto parts building in the back of the mall, which again was proposed, I think, about two and a half, three years ago, and it got shot down. I wonder what the no would be. Now, apparently, according to this story that Chris read and I'm reading from too here, apparently it's a scenario where now that there's more green space added, that might make the plan a bit more acceptable to those in power in Milford. Anne Marie is in Stratford today. Anne Marie, hello. How are you? What's up?
Hi. Okay. I was going to talk about the proposed housing. I think they should do it. I grew up and lived in Brooklyn most of my life.
Yeah.
And they started building in not only what used to be warehouses, but they even took over school buildings and built apartments in them. So I don't see a problem with repurposing a building, from, let's say, retail to housing.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's done, and I'm sure anybody who lives at the mall would want to have some barriers between them and the actual stores that are, You have a parking space,
You don't want you don't want shoppers walking through your living room is what you're saying.
That's right. But, there'll be some, I'm sure there's some barriers. And I think the town should do it. Because if not, if the mall were to go under completely or so, it's going to end up being some sort of housing anyway. I mean, I could certainly see apartments or maybe cars, but apartments definitely for young people just starting out. A small place.
Sure. Definitely. And Anne-Marie, we hear all the time. What do we hear all the time? Oh, there's a crisis in housing. There's not enough housing in Connecticut. Oh, my God, the housing. Well, this would seem to me, Anne-Marie, to be ready-made here. And if I'm an owner of a mall, I'm saying, all right, I'm charging these stores rent. They come back crying to me every month. We're not doing the business where, you get somebody in there who wants to live there. They know what the rent is. And it seems to me, I could be wrong, Anne-Marie, it seems to me to portend a steadier cash flow. But I don't know.
Well, it's a mix. It's a mix. You know, just like in your portfolio, you have some more at-risk, investments that earn more money and some of the more the steady blue stock.
Yeah.
The housing would be the blue chip stock and the retail would be your more volatile.
Yeah.
If you were to look at a portfolio, that's what it would be, I think.
Good thought. Anne Marie, thank you. Good to hear from you. Anne Marie in Stratford, like she said, New York City native. And we see this now, the repurposing of buildings. So I like this. Is there any reason not to like this? Now, again, this, as my father used to say, one of his favorite phrases, don't do it half-assed. I don't think it's going to be half-assed or arsed. But apparently they're going to give it another shot here. The owners of the Connecticut Post Mall, Centennial Real Estate, they're going to try and schmooze the folks in the city of Milford who run the city to allow zoning changes to allow some sort of living spaces on the Connecticut Post Mall property primarily. And this was a thing a few years ago that was deliberated. And I remember, I think the city said it was, I think, kind of in conflict with the downtown area of Milford, whatever. But they're looking at redeveloping that Sears department store and the Sears auto store in the back there. And look, it doesn't mean, for example, that you've got to, and whether it's the mall in Milford or whether it's even Trumbull, and now there's rumblings I'm reading, well, you know, what are we going to do if and when, like, say, in the Trumbull Mall situation where, I mean, they're already redeveloping, I think, or repurposing some areas around the mall as well. But think about it. You've got these huge buildings. I mean, malls are big. Now, I'm old enough to remember when the Connecticut Post Mall was transitioned from an outdoor mall, then it became enclosed. Remember that? You can still find photos online. I belong to a couple of Connecticut local historic sites. Hey, here's the Connecticut Post Mall before it was enclosed. Wow, that's a long time ago. So would you live on a mall property? How about that? 203-333-9422. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Is that a good or a bad idea? Not just for the Connecticut Post Mall in Milford, but for Trumbull, for Meriden, for Hartford, the Crystal Mall out east in New London. Good starter for us on this Friday. Yeah, I would live there. Now, again, if you're going to have people living there, you've got to have security. Look, we know the problems that we're having in malls with cars being stolen and, you know, these mall parking lots being something like a meetup place for ne'er-do-wells. And I'm sure there'd be something put in line there. But what do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And as I like to do, especially on a Friday as we glide into the weekend, we can put the heavy, heavy, heavy stuff on hold here, get back to all the grousing momentarily, open phones next half hour. But let's do something fun today. I like to do this on Friday, and it's part of American history. Two, our next guest is a reporter for Bloomberg News, specializing in all things space. She was a past senior science reporter for the tech website The Verge. She hosted an online show called Spacecraft. She's the daughter of two NASA engineers. She grew up surrounded by the space shuttle and astronauts. She's also been published in Popular Science, The New York Times, Nautilus Magazine, and she's been on a whole bunch of TV appearances as well. The name of the book, The Sixth, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. Amazon, your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble. Lauren Grush is the guest. Hey, Lauren, it's Paul at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Great. No, thank you for being available here. I love this stuff, Lauren. I grew up a space runt. I kind of focused into this and the tail end of the Gemini project and then, of course, into Apollo and all that. Why, Lauren, and this to me is the most contrasting thing. The Russians wasted no time putting Valentina Tereshkova in space for obvious propaganda reasons. Yet we tested women, we looked at it, and we didn't do it for years. Why is that?
Well, I think it was just not considered a priority for NASA and the U.S. government at the time. So in the book, I do detail a pretty famous group of women, sometimes referred to as the Mercury 13. So they were a group of women who underwent the same tests that the Mercury 7 did, and they passed them, and they wanted to keep training for space, and they even lobbied Congress in order to do so. But ultimately, you know, they were turned down. It just wasn't seen as something that NASA needed to focus on. And you're right, when Valentina went into space, it was really brushed off as a publicity stunt and not seen as something super serious that NASA needed to do.
But that is interesting, though, that we brushed it off, or at least the big wigs did. But by the same token, Lauren, it did happen. But I guess there was also, from what I've read, worry about, hey, if we did this too early with a woman and she'd unfortunately be killed or maimed, they just didn't want to deal with the PR headache, did they?
Well, I think also that might be a bit of an excuse for why they didn't actually do it. You know, I mean, obviously the same kind of terrible tragedy did befall male astronauts, and, you know, NASA persevered as well. So I think it was mostly just an excuse and a biased excuse for not pursuing that route.
So now you highlight The Six. The name of the book is The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. Briefly, who are The Six? And I'm sure these are names that at least some people, if not most people, especially my age, would recognize.
Sure. So I think most people recognize the name Sally Ride as the first American woman to fly to space. But yes, she was joined by five other pretty incredible women who were selected right alongside her when she first came into the program. And those include Judy Resnick, Kathy Sullivan, Anna Fisher, Ray Seddon, and Shannon Lucid.
What made them The Six? And I'm sure you talk about this in the book, but how rigorous, Lauren, was the screening and the selection process?
Sure. So when they came into the program, more than 8,000 people applied, and it was narrowed down to about 200 finalist applicants who each had to come to Houston for about a week to undergo medical examinations, psychological evaluations, and an interview process to determine if they really were the right fit for the job at the time. And so ultimately, the six were the first six women that made the cut in that selection round. And they were the first women that NASA had ever accepted into the astronaut program.
How did they make that cut? What about those six, Lauren, were you able to ascertain? What characteristics, physical, mental, experience-wise, what made those six women rise to the top?
Well, for NASA, it was a lot of different criteria. So they were looking for, obviously, team players, people who could work well with crew members, you know, because they'd be working with a large array of people. They also wanted people who could be patient. I think most people don't realize that being an astronaut, you're only in space for a very small period of time. Most of your time is spent on the ground supporting other flights or getting ready for your own. So NASA wanted to make sure that they understood that and were willing to wait. And they also wanted people who had a wide variety of interests. And I think the six are a perfect encapsulation of that. I mean, look at Sally Ride, for instance. She was both an astrophysicist and a tennis player. And I think that worked in her favor because it showed that she wasn't just interested in one thing. She was interested in multiple different areas. And that was a very valuable trait for flying on the space shuttle because there were so many different things that people needed to do, you know, deploying payloads, flying, manipulating the robotic arm. So it was important to show that you had a very diverse background and that you were interested in multiple different areas and applications.
Lauren Grush is the guest. She's author of the new book, The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. And Lauren, you know, even to this day, we see now women deeply involved in the space program, from what NASA does to these private space companies. But space is still dangerous. I mean, it looks easy. But, you know, kudos to these women even more, because a lot of people that at least fly for NASA, you know, a lot of these people are still considered test pilots. This is not to the level of people would think, well, I just get in and start my car. There's still a lot of stuff that could go wrong.
Yes, it's definitely the phrase most people like to use, space is risky, right? And you should never forget that when you're flying on top of basically a controlled bomb that's taking you to space. Now, obviously, you know, when it comes to NASA and commercial companies like SpaceX, they go through rigorous testing and safety protocols. But yes, it's still something to be cognizant of whenever you're flying. And also, you don't want to get complacent. That's always kind of a concern as we make human spaceflight routine. You know, that was kind of one of the lessons of the Challenger accident, which I detail in the book, is that, you know, at the time, things were becoming a little lax and people were starting to accept more risk and deviant behavior with the technology. And so it's important to remember those lessons as we move forward with human spaceflight, because that risk will, you know, going to space and breaking free of Earth's gravity, that will always be a risky endeavor.
Was there ever a worry, Lauren, that the Challenger disaster would have had, you know, some people in NASA and maybe even the government say, all right, enough with this women in space thing or not?
Oh, I think the concern was not about women in space. The concern was about anyone in space. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time, there was a very big concern that the Challenger accident would spell the end of NASA's space program. And so everyone lobbied very hard to continue with the space shuttle and human spaceflight. Now, it was definitely a big wake-up call for NASA. They completely reevaluated their safety protocols. They, you know, went through all of their procedures and just streamlined everything, and they made sure they made some important changes to make sure that the astronauts would be have some kind of barrier, some kind of safety net when they were in space. It can be debated whether or not those changes actually worked, mm-hmm. but ultimately it did provide a bit of a, you know, a come to Jesus moment for the agency that did result in many years of human spaceflight, you know, following it.
How much sexism did these six women have to battle on their way up?
Well, you know, I would say the worst part of it was dealing with the press. You know, they were obviously very popular because they were the first six women. So mm-hmm. members of the media really wanted to talk to them, take their picture and interview them a lot. And so when they were asked questions, some of the questions that they received were pretty terrible. I think, you know, Sally Ride had to deal with the worst of it, being the first American woman in space. Her press conference before she flew was pretty famous for having some terrible questions, like if she wept when the simulator broke, if she would have quit the program if she had been only the second woman to fly. Someone asked her at some point if she had ever dreamed of being a boy.
Oh,
you know, some
good
questions
God.
That you would never think to ask a man, but unfortunately, Sally had to deal with them all.
Oh, man. The name of the book once again, and our guest is author Lauren Grush, The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. So now quite an adventure here where, you know, we have regular women in space on a regular basis. We have the Artemis project here, which will land the first woman on the moon. I think not next year, but they have to do a crewed test flight, and then the year after that. So the miles that these six paved for women in space, certainly a wonderful thing in the history of America and the history of NASA and the history of mankind, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest benefit of these women, you know, always someone has to go first. And so by them just being the first women and doing their jobs and going to space, you know, their experiences have made it easier for all of the women who have come after them. And so, you know, the women today who are in the space program, they have decades of other women to have as mentors, or if they ever need questions that are related to being a woman astronaut, you know, they have many people that they can turn to. And so that's ultimately the biggest benefit. And then also, thanks to Sally and the rest of them, hopefully they get asked much more enlightened questions in the future before they fly to space.
Did somebody really ask her if she cried? Oh, my God. Oh.
I do. I have a video evidence to prove it. So, unfortunately, that was a question that was asked of Sally.
And I'm sure the NASA PR people before and after said, grit your teeth. Don't say anything. We know you're angry, right, Lauren?
She handled it pretty well. You know, the video of the press conference is pretty perfect because you can see the expression on her face, and you know how much she wishes she could say what she wanted to say, but she, you know, she handled it very with a lot of poise, and that was just, you know, a testament to Sally and her personality.
Yeah, great stuff here, Lauren. Thank you, Lauren Grush, the guest and author, The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts. Lauren, thanks. Good luck, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. That's the name of the book, folks. And if you're like me, about my age, late 50s, early 60s, and you were a space kid, fascinating book. The Six, The Untold Story of America's First Women Astronauts, author Lauren Grush, G-R-U-S-H, and I should mention she does have a website. Want to give that to you just before we break here. LaurenGrush.com. LaurenGrush.com. Okay, we'll wrap this up next half hour with open phones. And I promise you, I will give you, before we wrap things up today, the latest example of the fact that we are losing our collective minds. Trust me, there are certain things I see in society, even more than politics and other stuff, where you read and you think it's satire, and it's not. I promise I'll do that before we wrap up today on WICC. Chris Caruso's here offering his every Friday wrap-up as to what he has had thoughts on throughout the week. Mr. Caruso, good afternoon, sir, and how might you be today?
Well, I'm doing fine. A little tired, but doing fine.
Chris, let me get started here with whatever you have on your mind, but I have to ask you, what are your thoughts regarding what happened this past Tuesday night?
Well, I had predicted, Paul, that it was going to be a close race, probably 300 to 500 votes, and people shoo-shooed me and said, oh, no, it's going to be 1,000 votes, and the mayor's going to have a blowout and everything else. But, you know, it's a little different when you're not in elected office and you just kind of listen to what people are saying. And sure enough, it was probably one of the closest races within recent times. And, you know, once again, the absentee ballots, you know, carried the day for the mayor. But, you know, what was so unusual, and I think I've said it on your show before, usually when the vote turnout is low, that usually favors the incumbent because people aren't going out looking for change. They're not looking to, in the old adage of throw the bums out, per se. So this one was so unusual because the turnout was exceptionally low. 6,000 out of 40,000 Democrats voted, and the low turnout actually went in favor of the challenger, in this case, you know, John Gomes. So it was kind of, everything was, you know, thrown up in the air and landed on, you know, one side. And it was just fascinating to see that. But I kind of sensed when I was watching the campaigns that, you know, the challenger, John Gomes, was, you know, picking up with the head of steam, is getting his message out and so forth. And, well, the rest is going to be history now in November. I think it's going to be a fascinating race to watch. You know, usually an independent candidate in Bridgeport, you know, very slim chance of winning because it's so heavily Democratic. But now it's like that chicken soup. You throw everything in the pot.
Yeah.
So now you've got unaffiliated voters, Republicans, Democrats voting, which expands the field. And, you know, it's going to be a race. There's no doubt about it.
Chris, what do you think made it such a narrow margin of victory, even when you combine the in-person votes and the absentee ballots? Why was it so slim, do you think, at least in the primary here?
Well, you know, I think any incumbent, in this case the mayor, whenever you're around long enough, you know, you're going to make mistakes. People aren't going to be happy with what you do. And I think to some case, the last 4 years for Joe Ganim, where there were a lot of mistakes, a lot of problems out there, you know, the A.J. Perez situation, you know, the former police chief, the acting personnel director, their criminal behavior leading to convictions, the freedom of information, you know, noncompliance with that. And there was a myriad of other things that I just don't think were handled well and could have been handled well, and I think that was part of it. The other thing was that if you look 4 years ago, Joe Ganim, you know, won the race against Marilyn Moore by a nail biter. So that should have been red flag going into this election, even though 4 years is a long time. But, you know, people that voted for Marilyn were probably looking for change. So you had that going on. And then frankly, John Gomes was able to reach into communities that haven't been reached into in a while. For example, the Portuguese community, the Brazilian community. You know, he speaks five languages, so he was connecting with people. And I think you put that together with people wanting change and the other fact that it wasn't a four-way race, which many people thought would be, including myself. It got down to a one-on-one. And so one-on-one is always a challenge for any candidate. And I think those were some of the ingredients that brought the race really close. And the other saddest thing about it is when you only have 6,000 of 40,000 Democrats coming out, people just don't care. Yeah. They don't see it as important enough to come out. They're wondering if their vote would make a difference, and people just stay home. And I think that's to some extent what happened here. I go back over 30 years ago now, but in 1985, when I managed Tom Buicey's campaign, there were 23,000 voter Democrats coming out in that Democratic primary. And now you're looking at what, 6,000? So there's a statement there that, people feel, hey, my vote isn't going to make a difference. Things are going to stay the way they are. And so they stay home. But in this case, I think many people went out to make a change. And I think that's what's shown. Now, in all honesty, an incumbent looks at that and figures out, okay, what am I going to do differently to kind of, gain support and confidence again by the voters? And I think that's where the Ganim campaign needs to sit down and really do a soul search on what's going to be a message for this election and what are they going to do differently if they are reelected to, bring pride and hope to this city, because it's a great city, a great deal of potential. But what are they going to do different if they are elected in the next 4 years to gain the confidence of the voters? If I'll be very honest with you, Paul, if they stay where they are now and they look at this 261 votes as a victory, they will lose. And, I'm being very sober about that. They will, very sober in my messaging, they will lose. If they see it as a wake-up call, then they have a better chance of winning, because then they can address the issues that people felt so strongly about.
Chris, what else do you have on your mind on this Friday?
Well, it's almost Columbus weekend coming up, Paul,
yes.
Believe it or not.
Yes.
And I've been working on putting together the Columbus Parade with our volunteers, along with two free Marine band concerts. And I just want to put a plug out there. The parade is going to be on Sunday, October 8th at 12 noon. It starts at Jewett and Madison Avenue, going down Madison. And it will end at a new thing this year, the Feast of St. Francis. It will be in front of Michelizzi, 712 Madison Avenue. And at the front end of the parade, at Crown Cafe, 2200 Madison Avenue, we're going to have a pre-parade central where there'll be discounted food, there'll be Italian specialties, there'll be an opportunity to take pictures with the Marine Band, but also the Philadelphia Mummers are coming as well, so there'll be an opportunity for the public to mingle with them. That's all three things happening on one day, October 8th. We're going to have the blessing of animals, which Francis was known for. He was the patron saint of animals. We'll do that about 3 o'clock. We're bringing in a band called Pop Rocks, which is 80s and 90s music, pretty popular group. And we hope everyone comes out. The two concerts are Friday, October 6th and Saturday, October 7th. Klein Memorial free concert, but you need tickets. And you can pick up tickets at the Klein Memorial or over at Port 5 in Black Rock or also Crown Cafe, 2200 Madison Avenue. So there's opportunity to get the ticket. So I call it the Spectacular Columbus Weekend, October 6th, 7th, and 8th, where people can come out and have a great time, and I hope they will come out and enjoy it.
Fabulous, Chris. Thank you. And, yeah, big stuff coming up on that weekend, and I'm sure you and I will chat about that beforehand. Chris Caruso, we appreciate that. Thank you, and have an excellent weekend, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. There you go. All right. So the big weekend, the parade on the 8th, the concerts at the Klein on the 6th and on the 7th. So there you go. And hopefully, I know in the past, Chris and I have been able to hook up and get somebody from those military orchestras to come on the show. So we'd love to do that. All right. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. No, Columbus Day is not going away. I know it's been, and we've had Chris on and a bunch of other guests about it, and I'm sure there's likely going to be, as there always is, a little bit of contentious discussion about the role of Columbus and Columbus Day and all that, and people have to understand people have to understand, and I'm sure they do, but any Columbus Day to a lot of, to millions of people who are Italian Americans. And I'm not saying you have to love it, you have to hate it, you have to love Columbus or whatever, but Columbus Day is to a lot of people, especially if you have any Italian lineage, because people come up to me all the time and say, hey, what's the big deal about Columbus Day? Oh, so let's honor somebody else. What's so big about Columbus? It's not so much about Columbus himself or where he landed or what he did or what he didn't do and what he's fairly accused of, what he's falsely accused of. But Columbus Day, maybe more than any other day on the U.S. calendar for those places and municipalities that still observe it or still will say something about it, it may be the most ethnically connected day in the year. It just is. Now, whether you think that's logical or not, what do you Italians care about Columbus? Well, again, for a lot of people, it's not so much caring or crooning about Columbus, although for some historians it is. But again, we've had numerous guests about this on the show year in and year out who have said this when that day is criticized or when Columbus is criticized or when it's flipped off by a lot of people who say, hey, what's the big deal? Move on. Well, you know, it is connected to the heritage of millions and millions and millions of people in this country. And you may think that's right. You may think that's wrong. But, you know, it is what it is. And as much as we hate that phraseology, it literally is what it is. So the big doings coming up, and we still have about three and a half weeks to go before that. So we will tend to it as we get closer. All right.